Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. For those who are working on or concerned about alleviating global poverty, an emerging trend has been the development of non-governmental organizations that are highly focused on a single community in order to truly affect long-lasting change. Often the organization doing the work raises their funding from a single community or a series of communities because funders can see that their donations are having a direct impact on the developing community. Over the past several years, Studio Tulsa has featured several of these organizations serving communities from Uganda to Ghana and Nicaragua. Today we hear about a Tulsa-based children and community NGO serving rural Tanzania. The Janata Bachelor Foundation for Children is celebrating its 10th anniversary this spring and serves the rural community of Katongo, Tanzania, which is located on Lake Victoria, about 35 miles from Mwanza, Tanzania's second largest city. There they provide shelter for about 50 orphan children, operate schools for around 350 children, provide health care, and are helping the rural population with economic development and permaculture agricultural techniques. My guest today is the founder of the JBFC, Chris Gates. Chris Gates, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
This foundation that you've headed up, the Janata Bachelor Foundation for Children, is now celebrating its 10th anniversary. Give us a sense of how you started it and why you wanted to start this foundation that's helping kids in Tanzania.
Well, my path to Tanzania actually started on kindergarten career day. I stood up and said, I want to be an exotic animal veterinarian in the Serengeti National Wildlife Park of Tanzania, East Africa. And my grandmother promised at the time that when I got older, she would take me on a safari to Tanzania. And as we were planning for the safari, she threw a little wrench in the chain and said, you know, in order for you to get the safari that we've always talked about, I want you to go and volunteer and see what the country's really like and what Tanzanian people really live like. And I dragged my feet. I said, absolutely not. I don't want to go. And she said, well, tough cookies. It's both or none. And so we ended up volunteering for 2 weeks at a center for street boys in Mwanza, the second largest city in Tanzania. And I immediately fell in love with the culture and people and everything about that population and ended up devoting the rest of my high school summers to working with that center for street boys. And one of the things that I noticed as I got to know the culture, the language, that population better and better was that there were a lot of opportunities for the boys in the area and not much was being done for the girls. And so back in 2006, we founded JBFC, or the Janata Bachelor Foundation for Children, and we were originally just devoted to providing a safe and loving home for orphaned and vulnerable girls. Mm-hmm. From that, we've really grown into a holistic care organization. We realize that not only do we need to, you know, love and nurture these girls, but they also needed an education. We were in a village where the village school had over 900 students and only three teachers.
Wow.
So education was not happening.
A lot of rote learning.
Yeah. A lot of rote learning.
Basic rote learning.
And I would say most of the days our girls would go to school with their hose and would actually farm for the teachers instead of enter the classroom. Mm. And so we decided that we wanted to start our own school and be able to provide education and a high quality education to the boys and girls in our area. And from there we, you know, had a couple hundred kids and we realized we needed to feed them and we needed to model self-sustainability. So we started a farm and we now use that farm as a living classroom to not only feed our students, because we have over 340 students in our day school and they get breakfast and lunch every day. But we use that farm not only to feed our students, but to also teach our students and community members the methods of agriculture that we're using.
Now, I would think, is agriculture pretty well ingrained in that population already?
Absolutely. It is very, I mean, very much ingrained.
What do you need to teach, though? Or are you teaching new techniques?
Yes. So we are teaching new techniques. We use permaculture, which stands for permanent agriculture. And we try to integrate a lot of various crops into one field. Typically in Tanzania, most families would just plant maize and beans. And on a good rainy year, that would be enough to feed their families.
And those are mainly subsistence crops, right?
Correct. Correct. But what we do is we try to integrate some profit-making crops like fruit trees, wood trees, other types of fruits and vegetables so that these trees, even on a bad rain year, can still produce. And on a good rain year, they can have their substantive crops but also have a little bit of profit from their farm as well and not just get by.
And you're also growing fairly exotic things like passion fruit. And I would assume that is all for export. Or is it consumed on-premises or in the area?
So we do have a wide variety. I mean, we have papaya, passion fruit, pineapple, avocado, tangerine, limes, lemons. We do try to give our students and our residential girls a nutritious diet and try to balance that. So they do eat quite a bit of the food that we produce. But beyond that, the excess we do sell in local markets.
Oh, local markets. Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned at the top, you said, you know, I was just fell in love with that particular culture, Tanzanian culture. What was it about Tanzania that caught your imagination? Was it the Serengeti? I mean, that's when you think of Tanzania, you think of, you know, the great wildlife of the country. But what is it about the culture that attracted you?
You know, when I look back on that first trip to Tanzania, and I spent a month there, 2 weeks volunteering, 2 weeks in the Serengeti and other national parks, it's not the safari that I remember. It's the beauty of the land and the villages and the people that I met. They're one of the most hospitable people groups I've ever met. They're one of the friendliest and happiest, despite all of the challenges. And I think it's it really mesmerized me how this entire group of people can just be so happy, so hospitable, so giving, so friendly in the face of such extreme poverty.
Your area where you're located is right on the banks of Lake Victoria. On the opposite side of the banks of Lake Victoria, you're seeing all sorts of ethnic strife, ethnic populations clashing with each other over some of these artificial boundaries that are in Africa. Any of that situation in Tanzania and Kenya to the north?
So we do border Kenya, and they've historically had some issues with tribalism. But in Tanzania, we're very fortunate. Politically and culturally, it's a very safe country. The tribes really do get along quite well. They have their running jokes between each other, but the entire country, since its independence, has really been pretty...
So why do you suppose that's different? Safe. What is different about that particular... because you're seeing really tribalism throughout Central Africa, with the exception of just a few places. And Tanzania seems to be one of those places.
I think one of the main reasons is that there are so many tribes in Tanzania, a single tribe cannot
dominate
and gain complete control. There's over 120 tribes. They all speak their own dialect, and many of them are just too small to ever dominate, and so they have come to the point where they just live peacefully together. Whereas in other countries, there might just be kind of two predominant tribes that fight for power, or three or four, and that's where kind of that struggle can take place.
Well, after spending that summer helping the boys in Tanzania, you decided to really develop a campus, and you chose Katongo, which is in, I think, northwestern Tanzania?
Kind of northeastern.
Northeastern.
It's right between Mwanza, which is the second largest city in Tanzania where I first went to volunteer, and the Serengeti. Mm-hmm. So it's just about 30 minutes east of Mwanza.
Yeah, and it's on the banks of Lake Victoria.
It is on the banks of Lake Victoria. I never wanted water to be an issue with our crops and campus, but it also was a beautiful site. I knew I wanted to be in a rural village, and had our first assistant director, who was a Tanzanian national, look for several sites, and we went and visited them and ended up falling in love with that one.
Yeah, and I guess the first part of it was creating a refuge for orphans. And orphan girls.
Correct.
Give us a sense of how many kids are orphaned. I assume this was, since this has been 10 years, this is in the wake of the AIDS epidemic, and you've got a lot of kids that have been orphaned by their parents?
There's a variety of reasons in Tanzania for a kid not living with their family or being orphaned. Malaria is still a big issue.
Yeah,
HIV, typhoid, those are all major causes of death among parents and children in Tanzania. Current statistics say there's about 1 million orphan children in Tanzania.
Wow. And you're housing how many?
We house 48.
So this is one of the questions I want to get at is what we're starting to see is these non-governmental organizations that instead of trying to tackle a province, a country, they're tackling one single community. And sometimes their funders are sort of as locally based as the people are helping, this sort of micro sort of approach to alleviating poverty. What are the benefits of doing it that way?
You know, I think one of the biggest benefits and the reason we believe in our model and what we're doing and why we keep it manageable is that we are creating a long-lasting, sustainable, and deep impact. You know, we are not just trying to solve surface problems. We are trying to be a part of a community long-term and make significant changes in the lives that we touch. and not just, you know, here's a scholarship for a few years or here's this, here's that. You know, we, when we take our girls into the residential program, we commit to staying with them and caring for them until they graduate secondary school. And we're committed to making sure that, you know, when they graduate from secondary school, they're able to go into a trade school or a university or college. And then we are devoted to helping them go back into the community and reintegrate and find a job and be contributing successful members of society, because they are going to be the ones to alleviate poverty, not us.
Right. So it began with a refuge.
Mm-hmm.
You refuged 48 girls.
Correct.
And at that point you said, wow. You look at educational conditions. That was that the next step, was to create a school?
So we, when we first started in 2006, we were just able to build one house, and we were only able to take in the beginning of 2007, seven girls.
Mm-hmm.
So we started very, very humbly. We had a very small operating budget, and I was in college managing the organization at the time. So we, you know, also had a lot of hurdles to convince people that this is what I personally wanted to do with my life and what I'm passionate about, and it wasn't just a fly-by-night dream that I had. And so the beginning, we just started very humbly and slowly added girls on, slowly added buildings to our campus. And so, you know, kind of in the past few years, we've developed all pieces of the model together.
Mm-hmm.
So we've added to the refuge, while we've added to the school, while we've added to the farm, while we've also created a healthcare clinic.
Tell us about the next step of, you know, once you had a refuge, you said, well, we have to provide schooling. And I guess that schooling has also changed over the years, over the 10 years too.
Absolutely. When we first started the school, we started with preschool all the way through sixth grade, and now we have all the way through the end of secondary school, which is the U.S. equivalent of 11th grade. And so we've added a year each year, and actually as of last December, we had our first graduating class.
Wow. Now, of that first graduating class, I would think that would be of how many kids was it?
So we had 28 students in that graduating class.
So I want to make sure people understand that there's a refuge for the girls that are orphans, but you're actually opening the school to the community.
Correct. So we have 48 girls in our residential program, and we want to keep it small. They live in individual self-contained apartments, no more than 8 girls who live with one matron. And we want to keep those kind of family units intact and not make it an institution.
Right.
But we also do want to affect more change in the community. And in order to accomplish our mission of alleviating extreme poverty, we do feel that we need to educate more than just our residential girls. So we have over 340 students in the school.
Wow.
And
so you had,
girls.
And you had your first graduating class. What of those 20 kids or so, what are they going to do after graduation? Are they going to trade schools? Are they working in the community? Or do you have some that are going to university?
So it is all of the above. We do have some that will be going to trade schools. We have one girl who's actually this week enrolling in a tourism program. It's a 2-year course to learn all about hospitality, because tourism is one of the main industries in Tanzania. We have several girls. We have one who wants to be a dentist. We have several going on to university. We have several going on to teacher colleges, nursing schools, you know, you name it, and they dream it.
Now, is there any sort of commitment to come back to the community? If, as you've educated these kids, I think part of the thing is to help develop the area. Mm-hmm. Is there any commitment from these kids to come back to the area, or will, like a lot of people with education, you leave the rural area to an urban area?
You know, I think realistically it will be mixed, and we want to support them in whatever, you know, they want to do and be most successful in. I do think there are several that are from that area and really committed to seeing it grow, have seen it grow over their childhood, and are committed to making that change longer lasting. And I do think there are several of our graduates who truly believe in our mission and have expressed an interest once they graduate from university or teacher colleges in coming back and even working with JBFC.
My guest today is Chris Gates, the founder of the Janatoff Bachelor Foundation for Children. They operate a campus in Kitongo, Tanzania, that is helping the community, a school of about 300. They have a refuge for orphans of about close to 50. They're providing health care. They're providing rural economic development in the area. They're celebrating their 10th anniversary, and I guess most of your funding is right here in Tulsa?
So a little more than 50% of our funding comes from Tulsa, and this is our home base here in the U.S.
Yeah, and they'll be celebrating that 10th anniversary with a fundraiser, Tanzanite Night, Friday at the IDL Ballroom, and you can learn more at jbfc-online.org. Well, out of those first two initiatives, you mentioned one of the main scourges of the area. I mean, yes, HIV takes its toll, but malaria is this long-term killer in Africa. And it's really amazing that even with all the malaria efforts, malaria still takes an incredible toll of not only young people, but adults mm-hmm. as well. What are you doing on the healthcare front?
So we have a full-time registered nurse who is able to test for malaria and treat it. One of the things about malaria is that it is a very treatable disease. And if people have access to basic healthcare, they don't have to die. They don't have to suffer from malaria. They catch it early. They take a few days of basically an antiparasitic medicine, and they go about their lives. And so what we're doing is helping to, you know, catch early on the disease itself, but also she works in the community with our school to educate people about how they can prevent themselves from getting bitten.
Is it also a prevention program of like a, you know, netting and the usual techniques in trying to prevent the spread of malaria?
Correct. And we've worked with the government. They've given us mosquito nets to give out to our residential girls. They've done it for our students in the past. And so we do try to, you know, educate people about how to properly use those nets as well.
Yeah. So you have a nurse in the area. Is there any plans to build up healthcare in the future for the area, or do they already have pretty good healthcare within that area?
You know, in our village, and the reason we decided to have a dispensary, a small clinic on our site, people would have to walk about 12 miles to see a doctor. And so we really wanted kind of a first responder band-aid clinic, for lack of a better term, where, you know, our nurses really devoted to preventative education, but is also there as kind of a backup and referral source. And so we've been really excited about the successes we've seen in the year and a half since we opened the clinic.
Mm-hmm. Is there any plans down the road to add a doctor to the area, or you think the healthcare nurse, sort of a triage nurse, is probably the best?
In this area, the triage nurse seems to be working. We do have medical groups that come over and provide specialties in our clinic and are able to provide, you know, extra medical care. But just on kind of short-term basis. And yeah. So that's really the model that we've taken. I think as we look at growing as an organization, we do want to have other campuses and other sites across Tanzania and East Africa. And if the community need there was to have a doctor or a much larger clinic, then we would obviously respond to that community need. Yeah. But currently in Kitongo, our first campus, you know, our nurse seems to be doing a good
now,
job.
Is the campus sort of a place for the whole community, or is it mainly a school for the kids? Or are you really working with the whole community, like parents, grandparents, the whole, you know, from the aged to the young?
We do really work with the whole community. You know, our campus, and many people when they picture a campus think of a closed off gated area. It's actually just a little over 70 acres of open land in the middle of this village. And so people actually walk through all the time. It's an open access road. We have within our school even family literacy nights that we've recently started. So we're helping to improve literacy of not only our own students, but their parents and other community members and the village government, village elders. We also employ over 70 local staff, and so that is a major economic driver for the community and that local economy. And we also educate the community members and other organizations about our techniques using permaculture. Mm-hmm. And so we really try to engage not only our students and the kids, but also other key members in the community so that they can take what we're doing on our campus and help to replicate that.
So the fourth peg of your stool is sort of the rural economic development. And what are you doing on that area other than the permaculture techniques? Are you offering any other ways of helping the community develop some cash and economics?
So the only beyond the rural economic through development through agriculture that we do of educating people how to use their farms and make them more profitable, the only other program we have with that is an employee loan program. And so if an employee has been with us for more than a year and they want to start a side business or they want to do something in the community or in their own family to improve it, then we will give them a loan. Yeah. So we do that for our employees.
So give us a sense of the economics of that particular area. Are you looking at, you know, subsistence poverty, dollar a day sort of situation for most of the families?
Most families in our community and across rural Tanzania still live on less than $1.25 a day. Mm-hmm. And that's very typical in our area. And there are several people who run businesses do fairly well, but for most of the families, they are living mm-hmm. in extreme poverty and are just sustenance farmers.
Yeah. What impact do you think has the school and the facility had on that local community? As it, you said, it's sort of a driver of the local economy. What impact has it had?
It's funny now that we're celebrating our 10th anniversary and kind of looking back at original pictures. When we first came into that village, there wasn't a single tin roof or cement floor. They were all mud huts with grass roofs, dirt floors. And now as you look across the village center, it's scattered with tin roofs. There's cement floors, cement walls. We also provide water and various taps across the village, and so they have closer access to water. There's just been a lot of change, physical change, that you can see that's happened in the past 10 years since we've been there.
Now, a lot of these little micro projects are about creating economic development within the community. Will that be the next step for you guys to sort of help transform that area, or is it really going to focus on education and that next generation?
You know, we are really focused on education and that next generation, and where the kind of economic development comes from, it comes from our staff, because they are, like I said, in one community that's over 70 people that have a good living wage, that are able to take loans and start businesses, start different things, and they are really the ones that are the catalyst for change.
Hmm. What are the future plans for the organization?
So we would really like to take this campus model that we've developed, because we have seen the impact that it's had on the lives of these hundreds of children and this community, and replicate it in other rural areas of Tanzania. So we're devoted to creating a second site and hopefully a third, fourth, fifth in the future.
Yeah. Have you identified a second site yet?
We do have a spot in mind that we're working on developing and trying to really go about it in a strategic way.
Now, how important is the support of the community in making a difference like this? It sounds like you had a very supportive community, or was there some winning over to do?
I think there is definitely some winning over to do. In the beginning, just getting buy-in from the village government was difficult, because I think across Tanzania and other parts of East Africa and Africa, they see a lot of international organizations that
come in and leave.
Yeah. And, you know, I think now that we have a 10-year track record, we can go with confidence to other communities and say, you know, come and visit our community, come talk to our village government, come talk to elders, come talk to our staff, and see what we're about. And so that gets us a lot more, you know, instant buy-in than we had in the beginning.
How close is the relationship between the school and the facility and the village government and the elders? Is it pretty tight at this point?
It is very tight.
They're seeing the difference.
Absolutely. And they use even our administrative building many times for meetings. They will hold community meetings in our dining hall. So they, you know, we work very closely with the village government and village churches and other entities in the community.
Now, it sounds like you sort of assessed the area before you began. You said most of the area was living on less than $1.25 a day. With the permaculture techniques used in agriculture, with the staff that are obviously not only building their own businesses or spending money within the community, whether it's putting up concrete walls or in floors for a house and a tin roof or what, are you seeing this sort of trickle-down effect where maybe more people are living above $1.25 a day?
Absolutely. We have seen a lot more families that aren't even directly connected to our organization that have seen what we were doing, or maybe they take a permaculture design course and they replicate what we're doing in our farm and really start to be able to afford more, start to be able to build a real house, start to be able to send their kids to our school or other, you know, nice things in the area. And so, I mean, there is a trickle-down effect, and it's nice to see even our neighbors implementing our farming techniques.
All right. Well, this Tanzanite night, this Friday evening, Tanzanite is a gemstone in Tanzania, right?
Correct. It's a rare gem, about 1,000 times rarer than a diamond found in the foothills of Kilimanjaro. So only one area in the world can you find Tanzanite.
All right. Well, the fundraiser for that, and if people want to learn more information, I guess the website is the best place to go?
Correct. jbfc-online.org.
All right. Well, Chris Gates, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Chris Gates is the founder of the Janata Bachelor Foundation for Children. The JBFC is serving the rural community of Katongo, Tanzania, and they're celebrating their 10th anniversary this spring. They'll also be having a fundraiser this Friday evening at 6 o'clock called Tanzanite Night at the IDL Ballroom. You can learn more about the event at jbfc-online.org. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Janet Pearson.
You know it's going to be one of those days when you have to grab your pistol before breakfast and fire a few shots into the air to break up a vicious dogfight. That's not the only time we've had to reach for a firearm out here in the country. There was the time the neighbor's enraged Rottweiler charged us, and the time a lost drunk mistakenly turned down our driveway at 3:30 in the morning. Fortunately, there were no injuries in any of these incidents. Like millions of other Americans, I feel safer having guns in the home. I'd bet that most Americans agree we ought to be allowed to own guns for protection, or even just for the fun of target shooting. Why can't we also agree that something as deadly and easy to use as a gun ought to be taken a lot more seriously? The statistics regarding guns in America are so staggering, so mind-boggling, they almost sound made up. It's estimated there are more than 300 million guns in America. In other words, there are almost as many guns in America as there are people. On one particular day last December, there had been more mass shootings in the country than there had been days in the year, according to a report on the Today Show. The December 2nd San Bernardino massacre marked the country's 355th mass shooting in 336 days. As this horrific toll mounts, so too do gun purchases and permit applications. The Today Show reported that in November of last year, the FBI processed more than 2.2 million background checks on would-be gun buyers. On one day alone, Black Friday, a record 185,345 background checks were conducted. Then in December of last year, the agency processed a staggering 3.3 million background checks, a new record high. There's much more to this uniquely American phenomenon than the headline-grabbing mass shootings and predictable follow-up stories. The horrible, tragic reality is that more than 30,000 people die by firearms every year in the U.S., and in most cases, those deaths won't be big news stories. The vast majority of gun deaths don't occur during mass shootings. The vast majority, in fact, are caused by handguns. About two-thirds of those killed by firearms took their own lives. Most of the rest of the killings are homicides. The U.S. is all alone on the planet when it comes to such horror. No other country in the world tallies statistics even approaching what is experienced here in America year in and year out. Yet, we do little or nothing to stem the carnage. In fact, in some instances in recent years, states have expanded gun ownership rights in the wake of multiple tragedies. Sure, we debate the topic endlessly. There's regular hand-wringing about the need for more mental health screening and treatment, but not much changes. In fact, periodic budget woes ensure those services likely will never be adequate, at least not anytime soon. Calls for tighter restrictions on sales and bans on specific weapons are immediately met with fierce opposition, and the stalemate predictably, tragically continues. President Obama's plan to tighten up gun sales, not surprisingly, elicited instantaneous howls of protest. Opponents trotted out their tired rhetoric about how more restrictions will only make it harder for law-abiding people to get guns. Oh yeah, how do they know that? How do they know more restrictions won't keep more guns out of the wrong hands? We haven't enacted enough meaningful restrictions to know whether they work or not. At least Obama did something, which is more than can be said about nearly every other politician in the country. If we don't do something, even if it's not a cure-all, then we have consigned ourselves to being the most violent nation on earth. If we don't take some steps, however minor they may seem and however ineffectual they may prove to be, then it means we have simply given up. We're better than that, aren't we?
Janet Pearson is a former op-ed writer for the Tulsa World, a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa, and one of the newest members of the Oklahoma Journalism Hall of Fame. We congratulate her. She'll be inducted into the Hall of Fame on April 28th on the University of Central Oklahoma campus. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.